The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening! You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 18. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Kisto Healy, James Thurwell, and Dale Thompson. Tonight we'll hear stories of distressing dates, mortifying massacres, and methodical murders. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Is there any wonder why true crime podcasts are a big thing? We have a fascination with those who take the lives of others into their own hands, be they just regular, ordinary folks who just snap, people with serious issues that they've never dealt with, or, when it comes to the truly bizarre, people who come back from the grave because they just couldn't get enough gore the first time around. We check in first with Kisto Healy, and a fellow who has a thing for art and beauty, though his canvas is a little unusual. Though maybe, just maybe, a little normalcy is all he needs. But will it be enough? Without further ado, I present to you A Date with Death. Gerald closed his computer with a smile. He felt an electric tingle run through his body. He didn't associate with many people outside of work, and most of the people at work he not so secretly hated. He had his mother, and she loved him more than any mother loved their child, but he longed to meet someone new, to have a friend. His mother got jealous whenever he tried, so he had to keep his attempts at socializing a secret from her. The computer was the best way to do that, since she never used technology outside of the old tube television in the living room. Gerald's father used to tell him that not only his mother could love him, his father was not a good man, he wasn't missed. In fact, Gerald hated how much time he still thought of the old man and heard his voice in the ether. If only he could kill the memories like he was able to kill the man. Unfortunately, Gerald's abuser lived on in his mind. He supposed that was the penance he had to pay for what he'd done. But none of that mattered now. Gerald had a date, a real date. He couldn't wait to meet Valerie in person. He'd been talking to her online for months, talking through typed texts in a chat box, even talking on the phone. It was so different than being in person. Sure, he knew that Valerie loved true crime and industrial music, but he didn't know her truth because you could never know anyone's truth without feasting your eyes on them, as far as Gerald was concerned. It was all about the skin. Nothing told the truth like the flesh. Your whole life was there, the scars, the moles, the hair and freckles, tattoos, and piercings. It was the affectations that separated one person from another. Gerald's father was the monster in his closet, the beast under his bed, his boogeyman. He was a living, breathing nightmare, and yet without his skin, he was the same as everyone. He was just tissue, muscle, tendons, ligaments, and bone. He was no longer frightening. There was nothing to make him unique or special. If Gerald were to skin anyone else, they would look identical to his father. What made the old man frightening was that gross mole with the hairs coming out of it by his right ear, the tattoo of the devil smiling on his shoulder, the scar inside his belly button where he had been stabbed when he was young. There were so many details that Gerald's young eyes had focused on while he was being beaten, the belt buckle imprinting itself on his flesh and adding to his own story, his own uniqueness. All of that meant nothing when Gerald took it away. Looking at his father without skin was like staring at a department store mannequin. There was nothing sentient about it. So many people in Gerald's life, like that jerk Chad that he worked with, thought they were better than him, but he knew that they didn't. Underneath it all, they were identical, the same. No one was better than anyone. They were just decorated differently. Gerald was raised Christian, and it left him torn because the Christians, like his parents, believed that the soul was on the inside of the person. But Gerald knew that the soul was in the flesh. Removing one took away the other, and that was what set Gerald apart from jerks like Chad. Gerald had power, real power. He had his father's soul in a box under his bed. He bought some frames. They had these fun ones meant for collages and scrapbooking, with different shapes within them. It made his art more fun. When he removed his personal details, the things that made a person who they were, he cut them in the appropriate shapes to fit the frames perfectly. It felt like assembling a puzzle, crafting those masterpieces. He was working on a special room in his basement where he could work on his art and hang the finished products without fear of being caught or misunderstood. When that room was done, he would have his own little slice of heaven right there in his home. He'd have to make sure it was extra secure, of course, or his nosy mother would find her way down and punish him for not stopping with his father, but she just didn't understand. Not many people did. She also didn't understand that she was aging, changing, and it was becoming more and more difficult for Gerald to find her attractive. It made sense for him to look outside the home for someone who could please him, but his mother would never understand that. Valerie could be the answer. He often thought about what she looked like when they talked to each other through. He imagined so many details with backstories. Now that he was finally going to see her truth, Gerald couldn't help but fear that he was going to be disappointed, let down by his own fantasies. He'd seen pictures, but they were mostly her face or close-ups of one part in particular. It was an interesting part in the sense that no two he had ever seen looked the same, but it was rare to find something worthy of putting in a frame. She did have a beauty mark up by her eye and a chickenpox scar on her chin that he liked, like a tiny crater. It was the rest that interested him, and in order for him to complete his mission, he'd been dying to go on since they'd spoken for the first time months ago. He was going to have to make sure the date went well. People don't ordinarily take their clothes off for people they didn't feel comfortable with or have fun with. That meant to see what her flesh really had to offer, Gerald was going to have to be on his best behavior. He went to his kitchen and downed a shot of his father's bourbon to calm his nerves. It was the drink that made his father mean a lot, but Gerald wasn't his father. At least not while he was wearing his skin, he wasn't. He did have a lot of anger, though. He hated people and being around them. He hated how they looked at him, spoke to him, and treated him. He wanted to take them all apart and show them just how not special they were. He was far from a social butterfly, but he just had to get this right. He needed it. He wished he had his friends so he could have someone, like they always did in the movies or on TV, speaking into his ear and telling him what to do or say. Unfortunately, Gerald's only friends were his dear old mom, sleeping in the other room, and the flesh he'd taken and turned into art. The souls he stole that lived with him, a collection he was determined to grow. They were the best kind of friends he could hope for because they were beautiful. They told stories. They were all original and unique, and they never talked down to him, criticized him, or treated him badly. The flesh behind the glass never made a single complaint. They were like runaway models, just putting themselves on display for his admiration, and he appreciated every moment of it. If only the people who originally wore the skin realized his greatness and treated him with the same level of reverence. Gerald went to the bathroom and took a shower. He smelled himself several times until all he could smell was soap. Normally, he'd never do such things to his skin. He kept it clean, but he felt the scent of it was natural and part of the essence of the flesh. He was worried that Valerie wouldn't share such an opinion, though, and he needed to make a good first impression. He brushed his teeth and used mouthwash. Then he breathed into his hands and sniffed it up his nose. It was minty. That was good. Women liked that on TV. Gerald didn't date much, or at all, and TV was his only resource. He put on his finest suit, and even though he did believe he looked damn good in it, and it distracted from his bald head that made him look older than he was, he felt overdressed. If he'd overdressed, it could embarrass her and cause her to walk away from him before he got to see her truth. He didn't want to show up for a date in shorts and a t-shirt, but all he really had outside of that was the scrubs he wore to his job working sanitation at the hospital. He wondered if his father had something he could fit in. The old man certainly didn't need it anymore if he did. It was just bones now. The problem was that his father's clothes were still in the bedroom he'd shared with Gerald's mother. He'd have to think of something to say because she wouldn't like the idea of him going out with some girl he'd met on the internet. She didn't want him to go out with anyone. She didn't want him to go out. He had to work hard to convince her that he needed a job and that she'd run out of his father's life insurance if he didn't provide supplementary income. She was clearly unhappy about it and showed him by how rough she was with him that night. But she gave in and allowed him to venture out into the world. Since then, he made sure to always keep her involved and tell her everything about his day and the horrible people he worked with. Hearing about how much her baby hated those awful people made her feel better about letting him live amongst them. She became gentle again. This could shove her back over the edge of jealous madness, and a date he wasn't sure would go well could come with terrible consequences. Gerald loved his mother just as she taught him to, and he didn't want to disappoint her. She was always very vocal about how much his father disappointed her. It was part of what made his father hate him so much. His mother antagonized the man, and the man brought Gerald the violence. But he was free of all of that now, mostly. Gerald trod lightly in his effort to be quiet. He reached to his mother's room and held his breath as he turned the doorknob. When it opened inward, he sighed quietly upon seeing her sleeping soundly. He stepped into the room and stood over her for a moment. When she was young, she had been so beautiful. Now her skin sagged loosely from her bones and wrinkled up on itself. It looked scaly, like she was some kind of lizard. Her expectations of him hadn't changed, but something within him had. Then he thought about how, beneath that terrible flesh, she was exactly the same as Valerie, or any other woman 20 years younger than she was. He could restore her beauty by bringing her back to the basics, simplifying things. He just had to figure out how to do it without killing her. He needed her. The last thing Gerald wanted to do was kill his own mother. He leaned over by her and whispered into her ear as she slept, "Soon, my love. Soon I will make you beautiful again. Gerald crept over to the closet and sifted through his father's clothes. He found a sweater that was nice, but not too nice, and a collared shirt to wear beneath it. With his one good pair of jeans, that would do nicely. He snuck back out of his mother's room and closed the door gently. His dog padded over to greet him. Gerald smiled at him and gently scratched between his ears. "I'm going to meet a girl," he said quietly, still afraid his mother might hear. "Maybe she'll have a dog you can meet, too." A few minutes later, Gerald was dressed and on his way. He couldn't believe how nervous he was. He continuously wiped his sweaty palms on his pants. When he arrived at the restaurant, he was 4 minutes late and hoped that wasn't a deal-breaker. He smiled genuinely when he saw her sitting at a corner booth away from the bright lights. Gerald strolled over with false confidence and said, "Valerie?" "Hi," she said shyly. He sat down across from her. "It's so good to finally meet you in person." "Thank you. You look nice. I like the sweater." "It was my father's." "Did he pass?" "He did, but it's okay. He was a bit of a bastard." "Oh." Gerald saw the look on her face and he gritted his teeth. He couldn't scare her, not yet. The waiter came and took their orders. Gerald made sure not to order for or even suggest anything. Women got offended by things like that on TV and he wanted to be careful. He made his own choices by picking food that wouldn't spill on his father's sweater. He was hoping to put it back before his mother realized it was gone. If she found it stained, it would mean trouble for him. "Have you eaten here before?" she asked him. Gerald shook his head, afraid to say the wrong thing again. "Me neither," she told him with a shrug of his shoulders. "I like the atmosphere. Hopefully the food's good, too." "Hopefully," he agreed. "Tell me about that." He pointed at her hand. Valerie looked down at the scar that looked like a starfish where her thumb met her hand. When I was little, my brother stabbed me with a pencil. It was a stupid argument over who got to pick which cartoon we watched, and we both ended up at the ER, and neither one of us got to watch cartoons. Do you have any scars?" Gerald nodded. "My father used to take a belt to me. My back's pretty scarred up." He regretted saying it as soon as he watched her eyes widen in horror. He wasn't good at this, and he hated it. "Oh, sorry you had to go through that," she said. "I can't imagine how hard that was." "It was okay," he lied. "I'm fine. What about you? Any childhood trauma I should know about?" He was glad to hear her laugh and almost sighed with relief. "Not really. My parents were good people. I had a small, close-knit circle of friends. I stayed out of trouble. Pretty boring story, to be honest." Gerald smiled. "I think your story's more interesting than you give it credit for. You told me the fascinating story about the scar on your hand. What's the tale that led to the scar on your elbow?" "I have a scar on my elbow?" she said with a laugh. She bent her arm awkwardly and struggled to see. "I honestly don't know what I did or how long it's been there. You really pay attention to details, don't you?" "Of course I do. It's those details. The story on the canvas of our flesh that tells who we really are and what we've been through." "I like that," she said with a smile. "It's kind of beautiful. You seem like a poet. Do you write?" And Gerald chuckled. He was beginning to feel at ease in her company, which was so rare for him. "No, I do make art, though. I guess an artist's soul is transparent." "Maybe. I always wished I could be an artist, but I just don't have it. I can't draw, I can't paint, I can't write. I can't play music or sing with perfect pitch. I'm just hopeless." She punctuated the statement with an awkward laugh. Gerald took a chance and reached across the table to put his hand upon hers. "I can teach you," he told her. "You can come work on one of my art pieces with me, and I'll take you step by step through my process. Then maybe you can do one of your own." She lit up with excitement and his heart fluttered. "Wow, that would be an amazing second date, mister. What kind of art is it? Do you paint?" "No, it's hard to describe," he told her. "It's more like sculpting, weaving, sewing, collaging, and just using so many different mediums to assemble something beautiful. Like a sculpture." "Yeah, something like that. I'd love to show you. Well, I'd love to see, she said back, squeezing his hand. The food came and they ate in silence for a bit, just enjoying the choruses and savoring the taste. Okay, now this is good, Valerie said. It really is. I'm glad we did this. You know what, Gerald? So am I. Gerald grinned. So, Valerie, do you have any tattoos? Well, I've got a bunch, but this one's my favorite, she told him. She gestured to the side of the table, and he leaned over to see what she was trying to show him. She lifted her pant leg and displayed her calf. On the muscle, which he couldn't help but notice was rippling and strong, was a scene with trees and a sunset. Wow, Gerald said, that's gorgeous. I'd frame that and put it on my wall. I know, right? Guy did a great job. It was from a postcard that my childhood love sent me before he moved away and I never saw him again. I just always loved it. And of course, it comes with a romantic story, Gerald said, clapping quietly. I'm sorry if this is too forward, but I want to see the others and hear the stories behind them as well. Well, they don't all have romantic stories. At least I don't think so. But don't worry, I don't think it's forward. Hell, we've gone a lot further than that on multiple occasions, just not in person. Well, that's true. I really like you, Valerie. I like you, too. Should we get some dessert or just get the check and you can show me your art? Now, that's a tough one, Gerald told her, even though it wasn't at all. He couldn't give a damn about dessert, but he had to play his part and was determined to play it well. He got denied in all the school plays, but he was earning his part now. The good was so good that I know dessert has to be divine, but I do really want to show you my art and get you involved with it. Well, how about this, then? How about we get dessert to go and then take it back to your place and we can eat it while we create? I absolutely love that idea, he said with a smile. A short while later, they were outside holding hands, Gerald's other hand holding a bag containing cherry cheesecake. Should we ride together or do you want to follow me? Valerie chewed on her lip. How far is it? Can we walk? Gerald didn't want to be seen walking around with her by a thousand different eyes, but if he said it wasn't in walking distance and she followed him, only to realize it was, she would know something was up. He felt like screaming, like smashing anything he could get his hands on. It is in walking distance, he said, but I twisted my ankle earlier, and it's still kind of throbbing. Can I give you a rain check on the romantic walk? He grimaced when he saw her look visibly disappointed. Yeah, that's okay. How'd you hurt your ankle? My mother's elderly and she lives with me. I was carrying laundry down to the basement and I slipped and went right down the stairs. I'm lucky it was just my ankle and not worse, or this date may not have happened. Oh, poor guy, she said, hugging him and kissing his cheek. Is your mom there now? We're not going to disturb her, are we? Nah, it's fine. Like I said, she's old and sleeps a lot. I hang out in the basement and make art. You'll see. All right. I can't wait. You don't have a bed down there, do you? She batted her eyes at him. He grinned. I don't, but I do have a big table that you could definitely lay on if you wanted to. Sounds cold, she said with a laugh as they got in the car. Yeah, sorry. You sure you want to leave your car here? Oh, you'll be bringing me back for it later, won't you? All right. Thanks. Let's go make some art. Gerald smiled at her before he put his car in gear and pulled away from the curb. She was unconscious by the time they got to his house. He distracted her by pointing to her hand, and she didn't even notice when he poured the powder into her drink. It's the same stuff he used to knock his mother out so he could play without getting into trouble. Gerald carried her into the house, past the bedroom where his mother still snored quietly, and to a door across the way. He set her down so he could open it and then retrieved her, carrying her downstairs into the basement as promised. He laid her on a silver table that rested in front of the washer and dryer. He really needed to get that room built. It felt crowded as it was. Hope it's not too cold, he said as he strapped her in. His dog padded up to him, and Gerald smiled, patting his head. No other dog this time, bud. I'm sorry. I'll give you some meat, though. Once the skin's gone, the meat means nothing. The dog barked happily, then sat nearby and waited for his prize. Gerald walked to a work table nearby and grabbed his favorite scalpel. He stole it from work, and it was the only tool he ever used. It felt like an extension of his arm at this point. Valerie was starting to stir, and he was glad. He didn't want her to miss the fun. He was really glad he took a chance on internet dating. It really paid off. What are you doing? She stammered quietly as her eyes fluttered open. Exactly what you wanted, Gerald told her, his eyes glowing with excitement. We're going to make art together. I'm not going to kill you, don't worry. I need to see if I can do it and keep someone alive, so I can save my mother's beauty and preserve her. You won't be special anymore. You'll be the same as anyone in your state with no defining characteristics. But I want you to know that you'll always be special to me, and I'll keep the best of you, the pieces that make your soul in that frame over there. And if you still want to be intimate after your flesh is gone, I'll do that for you. You deserve it. Tonight has meant a lot for me. This is the best first date I've ever had. Thank you. Valerie started screaming. Gerald responded by smiling at her lovingly and making the first cut. A few feet away, the dog licked its chops and looked eagerly on, awaiting his treat. Soon, Gerald told the animal. Soon. Valerie continued to scream. Gerald loved the sound of it. Nothing had ever turned him on so much in his life. Today was a good day, he thought. No, a great day. He would definitely try internet dating again, as long as his mother didn't find out. Moaning happily, he took the chickenpox scar from her chin. I hope you enjoyed A Date with Death by Kisto Healy, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kisto-Healy. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Kisto-Healy. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. I guess some people can't lift themselves out of a rut in the end. They just go back to doing the same thing they always do. But hey, at least he's kind to his mother. That's got to count for something, right? Although, from the sound of it, they might need a little counseling in that department, too. And now, a quick glance behind the curtain with reporter James Thurwell, who apparently had an incident he had over the holiday season that he's just now willing to talk about. Maybe, though, it's a story he should have left to himself. Without further ado, I present to you, He Must Know. On the events of the death of Vincent Neumeier. I think with all the things I end up reporting on, it seemed inevitable I'd find something related to Halloween to report on. Not that I went out to report on it on purpose. I'd rather be celebrating with friends and family, enjoying a quiet holiday, enjoying the decorations I see as I pass by the houses in suburban neighborhoods. The story, however, is the thing, and when it comes to calling, it's not possible to ignore it. Or rather, when you drive by the story on accident. I will admit, I occasionally do drive around to see how people decorate for the season, whether it's Halloween, Christmas, or the 4th of July. The former two are the ones everyone goes all out for, and while Christmas seems to be the time where the decorations are happiest, I tend to see a lot more creativity show up at Halloween. I don't know if that just has to do with people having very different definitions of fear, but you'll see one yard with blow-ups from the Hocus Pocus movies and silly ghosts, and then another where blood-soaked murderous clowns with chainsaws stand in the middle of a graveyard where rotting corpses rise from fake graves. It was thus how I was taken by surprise when I saw police cars outside of a house that it took me a moment to realize that the carnage out front was not part of the seasonal decorations. I could see how some might have been fooled, though anyone who thought it was fake would have found it tasteless or too simplistic. Two bodies on the lawn, face down, clothes tattered and bloodstained, and a front window smashed outward as though one or both of them had been thrown with great force. It was clear, though, that the caution tape around the yard and the police officers gathered were not part of any decorations, nor the young boy sitting on the front steps with the blanket wrapped around him. I wanted to stop and investigate, but it looked like not only was I earlier than the traditional press due to my accidental drive-by, but I wasn't about to either interfere with an official investigation or ask questions of a boy who appeared to have lost everyone he knew. That, and I was waved along the street by a cop, and it's not like I have any sort of official press credentials I can wave around anytime I feel like it. I don't have the backing of a major newspaper, which I don't mind most of the time, but there are times when it would make what I do a whole lot easier. I got some of the information later from sources in the police department I could trust. As far as the boy was able to relate, the family was all together in the living room enjoying a night of watching movies when there was a pounding on the front door. A moment later, the door flew open and a powerfully built man stormed into the house. He spoke little, but he began shouting almost incoherently to someone who no one else could see. He asked questions to thin air, asking where the kitchen was, where he was going to find what he needed, and after a few seconds in the kitchen, he came into the family room brandishing a knife. The survivor, who I'll name Brandon for the story to protect his real identity, was shooed out of the room by his mother, though it did little good. Brandon's father was a sizable man himself, and he kept himself fit, more than capable of defending his family against most threats. But he, unfortunately, did not have the power of insanity and rage on his side. The murderer grabbed him by the throat and, while holding him, proceeded to stab him over and over. The coroner report suggested that he was stabbed well over 50 times, with most of them likely post-mortem, meaning the boy's father died in the clutches of the madmen, but he continued to stab away, driven by forces more powerful than we can imagine. The boy's mother, of course, was terrified, but stood her ground to protect her son. She, too, was stabbed numerous times, but the killer felt no need to strangle her. He was content to merely drive her head first into the drywall of the living room so he could complete the job. The remainder of the house he ran through, tearing apart cabinet drawers and scattering their contents. But though Brandon hid himself in the corner of his closet, the madman strangely ignored him. Even when the door of the closet burst open, the man merely screamed at him, then ripped clothes off the rack, and threw everything into disarray. His final act was to throw Brandon's parents through the front window onto the lawn, at which point he left through the front door and into the night. I couldn't imagine a scenario more terrifying than if a tornado blew through the neighborhood. It sounded so similar. Wanton, random destruction, leaving some items standing intact while leveling the rest. But the motive made no sense. Brandon swore he'd never seen the man before, nor had anything been stolen, and the rest of the neighborhood had been left unscathed. He had apparently, by chance, selected one house to be his target and had wreaked his vengeance upon it. No cult symbolism, nothing to even suggest outright malice. Brandon's family appeared to be simply the victims of being at home when the man snapped. As for the man himself, no one had any clue who he was. He was not a career criminal with a long rap sheet. Besides Brandon's testimony, the only clue to his identity was a few scant seconds of footage on the Ring camera installed on the front door. I unfortunately was not able to access the whole video, which was being held as evidence in the case, but I was given a picture as he kicked in the door. Brandon was correct about the size of the man, to be certain. He was clearly built like a weightlifter, and in fact, wore a leather vest with no shirt. I could not tell his direct ethnicity, but he was fair-skinned, but with long, drooping mustache and shoulder-length black hair. Forgive me for my references, but the only way I could describe in a way that made sense was the actor who played Machete's head on the body, the wrestler Triple H. As an aside note, I'm aware of the actor and Triple H's real names. I just thought this would make things easier for the reader to understand. The story itself registered in the local news for a few days, but as there were no further attacks, no one felt the need to be concerned, and life continued apace until he indeed did strike again. The victims this time were a couple of newlyweds with a 2-year-old son in a small apartment complex about 10 miles away from the neighborhood he attacked before. Other than that, though, the actual attack was very similar. Multiple stab wounds, signs of violence around the head and neck. They, too, had gone out the window, but as their apartment was on the second floor, their bodies took far more damage than Brandon's family. Again, no stolen items, the house was thrown into chaos, and nothing necessarily cult-related, and the toddler was left alive. But there was a difference this time around. One of the approved-for-release photographs showed our murderous friend had changed his M.O. slightly. On one wall of the apartment, words had been dug into the wall with a bloody knife. They read, "He must know." The police did inform me that the writing was baffling. There was no indication of who he was that needed to know. Speculation among my sources ran rampant, ranging from Brandon, the previous survivor, some ancient Mesopotamian god read about in books, a guy who lives in his eyebrow, and their personal favorite, Tony Robbins. Why Tony Robbins, I don't know, but it must have been an inside joke with the department. It was about 2 days before Halloween when a third house was hit, this one on the edge of the city, still a house in a neighborhood, but more urban than suburban. Another family, young, same general attack pattern, but like Brandon, the youngest was spared. But sadly, only the youngest. The parents, 31 and 29, and their oldest son, 10, were both found brutally murdered on the lawn, but the 6-month-old was still crying in her crib when the police arrived. They, too, had a Ring doorbell, and as before, there was no warning, just a mad rush to cause as much mayhem and inflict as much damage as possible. I'd come to the conclusion that keeping the children alive was significant to this whole process. It seemed so odd to leave them alive after doing so much else, and the fact that only the youngest member of the household was spared, not all of the children. But I was to find out that there was one other connection. Well, there were two, but let me expound one at a time. Following the autopsies of the first two sets of victims, I received some information on Brandon's questioning. Much of it was redacted, and I was reliably informed that, as expected, he didn't want to go into much detail and had broken down several times during the interview. But he did mention that the knife he saw when his mother told him to hide was unusual. He'd originally thought, as did the police, that the wounds were caused by a kitchen knife that was removed from the scene. But the autopsies revealed that the damage caused to the bodies was done with a pointed blade with double sides, that is, the kind you see in Hollywood movies used by thugs and cultists, similar to a small sword or some fancy letter openers. With very rare exceptions, kitchen knives do not have this feature. They do have single blades, only usable one way usually, to prevent anyone from slicing their hands off when chopping onions. With this knowledge, I thought maybe, even without any signs of a cult being involved, I still did some quick research on ceremonial daggers, and wouldn't you know it, it didn't take long to find the information. The fact that I did concerns me more about the people out there searching for this kind of thing than anything else. While I didn't come across anything truly mysterious, like some unique ancient Greek dagger that had gone missing from a museum, what I did locate was what was called an athame. Without going into too much of the specifics, the athame is a ritualistic dagger used in Wiccan ceremonies, and according to what practitioners are supposed to be using it for, our fellow was way, way off. This blade was meant for waving around in the air and carving herbs and roots, not for putting as many holes in people as possible. If this was the blade being used, and really, at this point, I was speculating since there was no direct evidence it was the case, it could mean there was some ritualistic purpose that was being committed here, or at least an attempt at a ritual. If I dug deep enough, I was sure there were things people didn't like to talk about those days that consisted of human sacrificial rites, but chances are they didn't begin with wholesale slaughter like what had just occurred over the past few weeks. I wanted some answers, but I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get them. Likely, he would just strike again, and hopefully this time someone would catch him before he got away with killing again. At least this is what I thought, until I saw the other thing that connected the cases together. In the third murder, I checked with my sources to see if there were any photos of the crime scene that they could release that were strange and unusual. Oddly enough, they were hesitant to give me anything which was very much unlike them. They told me I might find the information disturbing. Again, very odd, because I'd seen crime scenes of all kinds and didn't know what I would consider unusual. It took some convincing, but they finally shared it. Like the second house, there were more words carved into the walls, but this time there was little doubt who he, being referred to, was from the last time. James, James, speak to me. None of the victims had been called James. Nobody other than my sources on the police force knew I was looking into this, and none of them were a James as far as I knew, other than that first night where I stopped across from the crime scene near in my car. Had I ever been physically present, and yet he knew my name. How? And more importantly, why? And how in the world was I supposed to speak to someone who came and went like a force of vengeance? I spent the rest of the night unable to sleep, for obvious reasons, but I spent much of it staring at all my notes, the case files I was able to obtain, everything to see what would be the real story in all of this. Then I poked around on my phone trying to find something to eat, and it was when I got to the screen asking me to pick what location to order from that I got an idea. One of the things I never considered was a map. With the digital age being what it was, it never occurred to me to print out a physical drawing of the area and see if there was some sort of pattern in the places he hit. And wouldn't you know it, there was. The sites, when measured for distance, created a triangle, the tip pointed downward. It was amazing how neatly equidistant the sides were. I couldn't believe how neatly our fellow made the triangle, as I couldn't imagine he was someone who studied math a great deal, or at least had the patience for it in recent times. But again, the why of it. Why the triangle? Why the knife? Why my name? What's going on here? Too many questions, no answers. The only thing I could think of was try and see if there was something on the map the triangle was telling me. I checked where the points were to see if they pointed at anything, but no, they weren't showing me anything. Then I looked directly in the middle, and I saw nothing. No, that time there was something. I looked at it more closely. Dead center of the triangle was a street corner. I looked at it on an online map and on Street View. I saw the corner had an abandoned factory, two empty lots, and a church that likely hadn't been opened in years. A decommissioned church, Catholic. St. Francis de Sales, the sign read. Catholic church meant a confessional. James, speak to me. I contacted my sources on the force and told them I believed I might have an answer to some of the puzzle, but that I might need protection in the event something were to happen. It was a hunch, after all, and if it turned out to be correct, I didn't want to be there alone. I didn't know if there was a time in mind, but I gathered up some materials for jotting down notes, a handheld recorder and a knife of my own, just in case I needed it. but somehow I doubted it would be of much help if he wished me ill will. I arrived there shortly after 6 o'clock, October 30th. It was getting darker earlier, but even I was taken aback by how dark it was already. I pushed at the front door and wasn't really surprised to find it was not only unlocked, it had been kicked hard enough that it likely would never lock again. If he wasn't here now, he had certainly been here before. The church inside was still in decent repair, but it was very unclean. Cobwebs, scattered pews, some other loose furniture, but the guts of the building were still standing. And there was a confessional booth, just as I suspected. The side door where the confessor went in was closed, but the door for the priest was wide open. I walked carefully through the pews, making sure I didn't step on any loose nails, and closed the door. "Hello, James." I hadn't even gotten into my seat when a voice came through the window. "Hello, Vincent. I have some things to confess." I nodded, even though he couldn't see me. He went into a laundry list of things he'd done, not just recently, but throughout his life. By the time he'd reached the murders, it had been about 10 minutes. Vincent had not led a life anyone would find happy. Let's simply leave it at that. I won't horrify you or bore you with the details. "Yes, Vincent, you did kill those people. But why?" "Because they told me to." Now he had captured my interest. "Who are the they you're talking about?" "I don't know who they are, but they didn't ever talk to me until I had stolen this knife." There was a clatter on the other side, and I guess he must have placed the blade on the confessional sill. There was a shape I could barely make out in the gloom, but if my assumptions were correct, it was that ritualistic dagger, the athame, and it slid another puzzle piece in the right place. "Who'd you steal it from?" "I don't really know. It was in a display case in a store. I just know wherever it was that owned it prior, they either didn't know what they had or they knew and just didn't care." "Is it worth a lot?" "No, it's not worth anything. But it's the voices. They live in it." "What do they tell you, Vincent?" "Nothing I wouldn't already be doing, but they seem to know an awful lot about you." I gulped. This is where things were going to get strange. "Why do they know me?" "Because they know you are on the edge of things. I don't know you, but they've been listening. They know about the things you investigate and try to expose. In some ways, you're close to figuring it out, in others, still so far away." A part of me wanted to know more about this. Goodness knows it would explain a lot to me. But as excited as that part of me wanted to be, the rest of me wanted nothing to do with it. I think deep down, I didn't want to know why someone beyond our earthly realm had taken such an interest in me, and so I tried to change the subject. "The families, Vincent. Why the families? It's part of the plan." "What plan?" "The whole plan. I had to prepare the way. They need vessels, young lives, to enter this place and begin the first part. It's inevitable, and the doorway is the weakest on the 31st. "But who are they, Vincent? Who are they?" "I don't know who or what they are, but they've shown me what they're planning. It's a terrible and awesome sight, James. And give me a few moments and you'll be able to see it, too." This is the part where there's to be a large climactic fight scene between me and the murderer. But the thing is, this is real life, as strange as it might get, and it never got that exciting. I took off out of the confessional and hightailed it to the front door. I went out the front, hands raised, and dropped to the ground. Vincent came out a moment later, and he raised the dagger. The police waiting outside opened fire. For all his strength and all his viciousness, Vincent was not an immortal being, nor truly superhuman. In the end, he was stopped by 12 rounds of small arms fire, all center mass. October 31st came and went without a hitch. Naturally, with what Vincent had told me, Brandon had had tabs kept on him. but he seemed to suffer no strange personality quirks or behavioral changes in the days that followed, and appeared to be an otherwise normal kid, if now living with his grandparents. The other two boys were too young to know if anything had happened, but if the ritual could not be completed without me having my blood drained, or worse, then maybe the world has dodged a bullet in that regard. As for Vincent, I dug into his background as best I could, but there's where things take a turn for the worse, as he wasn't a career criminal with a record. As far as I could tell, Vincent was never a model citizen, but I couldn't pin a lot of blame on him either. Maybe he was just feeding me a pile of lies, or maybe he told the truth, but had never been caught. It was only his word, and that's all I will ever have. And that's my Halloween story. Make of it what you will, but I do hope, unlike me, that your holiday is spent at a nice party or with family and friends, and not subjected to violent madmen charging into your home. Still, I know my nights will still be sleepless for a while. I have plenty of security measures to keep unwanted spies out of my life. But what do you do against forces that are spying on you from across time and space? I hope you enjoyed He Must Know by James Thirlwell, as performed by yours truly. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Well, I don't know about you, but I found that a little anticlimactic. I hate it when a story builds up like that and then the world doesn't end in fiery chaos. It's just not realistic, you know? I hear San Francisco's lovely most times of the year. Yes, even with certain problems in the streets. But even in a place with scenic sights, some people just don't know how to handle themselves. Join Dale Thompson as he tells us the story of Melvin, who's decided he's going to make a mark on the city in a way that he hopes no one will ever forget. Without further ado, I present to you Nine Lives. Melvin Garland sat alone in his two-bedroom apartment on Burroughs Street, pondering the complexities of life. He was an odd one to be writing romance novels, yet he was fairly successful and had a medium-sized fan base. Melvin wrote under the pen name of Simon Hardy. He chose the name from two of his favorite writers. Melvin admired Claude Simon, the French novelist who had been awarded the 1985 Nobel Laureate in Literature, and the second writer that fascinated him was the poet and novelist Thomas Hardy. Melvin was odd for a number of reasons. At age 40, he'd never married, had no children, nor had an interest in family. The dark veil that he now wore over his life was pulled down 20 years ago when his beloved Maggie took her own life by jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge right in front of his pleading eyes. Since that time, Melvin had gone on in hurt and inner agony, withholding his heart from any other. Now his emotions were fortified by misery and lost love. Shortly after that tragic event, on that evening, Melvin checked himself into a clinic, claiming mental exhaustion. Therapy had been suggested for Melvin, and he complied in the beginning, getting a good repertoire with the psychiatrist, who was concerned that he may have onset schizophrenia. When Melvin heard this diagnosis, he immediately went into deep denial, explaining to his doctor that he understood the difference between real and unreal experiences. He was a man who could think logically. He had normal emotions of love, pain, joy, and hurt. He loved his privacy. However, he was not afraid of the outside world. His psychiatrist explained to him, in no uncertain terms, that although he may not have believed he had the onset of a mental illness, certain environmental events may trigger an irreversible episode. Melvin could not accept the doctor's findings. He was convinced that the doctor's conclusions were off base. I'm not suicidal. Yes, I'm depressed. But the love of my life threw herself off a bridge right in front of my eyes, Melvin protested. For a fairly successful writer, Melvin lived much more modestly. His apartment was cluttered with books and loose papers that contained ideas, scribbles, and written thoughts. Melvin was also fond of lamps that put the light closer to earth, he used to say. Melvin took the time to shower daily, though his dark, dull wardrobe needed some professional dry cleaning. His hygiene was probably above normal because he detested bad breath, dirty fingernails, stained teeth, and especially body odors. On this dull December holiday, Melvin sat behind his cluttered writing desk, gazing out of his third-story apartment window, taking in the distant, manicured John McLaren Park, while admiring the strings of multifarious blinking lights. Caught up in a thought, he tapped a number two wooden pencil loosely between his two fingers. His thoughts were often as scrambled as his writing desk. Like a slot machine viewing window, he never knew how the images would line up with the pay line. The payout today was a brand new prize for Melvin. He became lightheaded as a wave of warmth made him feel fuzzy inside. Melvin felt he'd hit the jackpot. No longer able to define the line of demarcation, he clearly spoke aloud words which made him shiver. I'm going to kill someone. Melvin went from being engrossed in his most recent romance assignment to thinking about murder. His romance novels never addressed murder. Every work that he had published were feel-good stories with happy endings, but today, something had changed him. It was difficult to say why Melvin's mind shifted gears from cruise mode to faster than the speed of light, but whatever the influence or reason was, he had veered off the highway of reason and logic, spinning down a dangerous path. Rifling through his bundles of newspapers, with scissors in hand, Melvin began to design encrypted messages that he would send to the police as teasers. That would be taunts to law enforcement. Catch me if you can. This was new to Melvin, who'd never even killed a mouse in his lifetime. He did not question where his power of life and death was coming from. He embraced it, suddenly, because he was rejuvenated with a rush of youthful excitement racing through his soul. The first message that Melvin prepared while wearing latex gloves for the police in block letters, clipped from newspapers glued to a plain white sheet of paper, read, "It walks on all fours in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the evening. What is it?" Clever. No prints, he thought, grinning to himself like a child that had snatched a piece of candy from the supermarket without being seen. He assiduously folded the letter and stuffed it into the plain white envelope. Being very pleased with himself, he used his typewriter to type the words, 9 in 9 days, on the envelope. He delivered the letter across the Golden Gate Bridge, mailing the letter far away from home. The deed was done. He was exhilarated with his first play in the game. Melvin knew he had the upper hand. He had no previous criminal record. He was not a homicidal maniac. There would be no sexual undertones to his killing. Just killing for the sake of killing. He'd pick random people that he had never met, so there would be no personal connection. There would be no exchange of emails, phone records, or dinners. The victim would be anonymous until the moment of death. It was a win-win, fail-safe plan. Acting from a conscious perspective, his plan was to commit 9 flawless murders in 9 days, then abandon the notion and simply walk away with the satisfaction that he had gotten away without suspicion. Melvin prided himself that he was in complete control. He didn't hear audible voices telling him to kill. He didn't have vivid dreams of murder. This was just something he decided to do. Melvin realized that he was a unique serial killer because the genesis of his killing would be unpredictable, and the penultimate act would set up the final scene. He had it all thought through. The garrot would never be placed around his neck, for his neck would be clean. The first step would be to find the first victim. He decided that his first victim would be on this particular evening. It was Friday, and the bars would be packed with party-minded people, drunk, high, and looking for a world far removed from their mundane 40-hour-a-week job schedule. This would be like shooting ducks in a barrel. His mind was a jigsaw puzzle, sliding all of the loose pieces into place. Dressed in his nicest dress shirt and slacks, Melvin placed a pair of black gloves in his pocket. He gave himself one last inspection and left to carry out what he had hoped would not be a cursory, murderous night. He wanted to take his time, leaving no clues. He headed to the Castro neighborhood, to the Lucky 13 dive bar. Lucky 13 was an inviting bar. Melvin would be able to blend in without anyone seeing him clearly. The crowd was an eclectic mix of punks and goths and a handful of other Melvins. He watched the bathroom door, waiting to see if anyone went in or came out. Melvin decided to use the bathroom for cover. He found a stall and waited. He heard the bathroom door open and someone came in. Whoever entered did not go to the stalls, they went to the urinal. Melvin despised the urinals. He couldn't understand how a grown man could urinate openly next to another man. It was like pissing in someone else's pocket. Melvin had to think quickly. He had no weapon. Time to improvise. He lifted the rectangular ceramic toilet bowl lid off the tank. It was heavy. It could be used with both hands for extra swinging power. Melvin slipped out of the stall and approached the man facing the urinal. Rearing back and tightening the grip on the cold lid, he was standing like a baseball slugger. He wanted the victim to see his death coming. As soon as the man turned, Melvin swung, unloading with all of his might. The blow to the head was so powerful that the lid broke in Melvin's hand. The unnamed victim fell back, a frozen expression of helplessness painted upon his smashed face. It occurred to Melvin, in a panic, to find a weapon that he had forgotten to use gloves. He knew his victim was dead. He was positively dead and growing cold. Melvin's heart raced, and his breathing became erratic. He ran to the paper towel dispenser and practically pulled every towel loose from it. He soaked the towels under the sink faucet with water, and then, like a madman, he scrubbed the possible fingerprints from the two broken ceramic pieces. He rushed to the stall and he wiped down anything that he thought he had possibly touched. He pieced the lid together and laid it back upon the tank. He realized he had been really careless. He had to go. He went to the body and looked down. He gasped audibly as, for a split second, the man's face morphed into his own, then back into its current smashed self. One last thing to do. Melvin dragged the corpse by the feet into the last stall and sat it up on the toilet seat. To himself, he said, "I'm in the clear." He took a deep breath and tried to act casual as he weaved through the bar. Head down, he went straight to his car. He fumbled for the ignition key. Once started, he turned the air conditioning on high. Laying his head against the steering wheel, he slowly took control of his breathing, for he had nearly hyperventilated. At the instant he raised his head and glanced to his left, the reflection in the driver's side window startled him. The image was not his face, but a mirage of his murder victim. His hands instinctively flew up defensively to protect his face. He blinked hard twice, and the mirage vanished. Staring back into his eyes was his own troubled gaze. When the magnitude of what he had done settled, he had a sense of accomplishment. Melvin could not imagine life clearer than in this moment, regardless of the aberrant behavior that he had just exhibited. It was not the perfect murder, but it was murder. He couldn't wait to read the headlines in the paper the next morning. Once home, he swallowed a handful of aspirin in hopes of getting relief from his developing headache. His head throbbed with a pulsating pain. The following morning, he filtered through the newspaper thoroughly. The big story of the murder at the Lucky 13 was nowhere to be found. He cursed and slammed a single fist against the table. He couldn't imagine how such a brutal murder had gone unreported. He finished up his normal morning breakfast while cutting and pasting a new message for the police. The message read, "I am the beginning of the end, and the end of time and space. I am essential to creation, and I surround every place. What am I?" He placed the folded message in the same type of envelope as his last one and addressed it to the police, with the typed message on a smaller piece of paper, which read, "Catch me if you can." He had some shopping to do. He wasn't about to get caught off guard again, like at the Lucky 13. He drove his car to Academy Piano Services, where he bought a single E string for a piano. Melvin didn't own a piano, didn't play piano, and he had no plans to start taking lessons. But the E string was perfect for strangulation of the next intended victim. Melvin dropped the letter to the San Francisco police in a different mailbox than the first one, and made his way home to prepare for the second murder. The sun was setting. Melvin decided to take a stroll in the park. Alta Plaza brought out the dog walkers and families with children. The park wasn't overly crowded, so he found a park bench that looked out at Alcatraz. As night fell, Melvin went out on the prowl. He walked across a thick, plush green yard and down a slope. He focused his attention on a man who had been hanging around the fenced play area where children had been playing earlier. Melvin eyed the man. He appeared dumpy in baggy clothes. His eyes were set close together, and he gawked stupidly in the direction of the last two boys playing in the fenced area. Melvin despised the man's appearance. He decided to make his move. Melvin followed, yet kept a distance. Both men were headed toward the restrooms. Melvin coolly slipped his leather gloves on. He heard footsteps inside on the tiled floor. Reaching into his jacket pocket, Melvin brought the piano wire out, wrapping it tightly around both hands and making two fists. His heart began to race, and he fought to control his breathing. The riddle he had sent to the San Francisco police raced through his head. "I am the beginning of the end, and the end of time and space. I am essential to creation, and I surround every place. What am I?" He mumbled the answer to himself. "The answer is E. The answer is E. The answer is E. That's why I'm using the E string of a piano." The exit door slowly opened, and to Melvin's advantage, the intended victim looked the other way before stepping out. Melvin slipped the piano wire around the man's throat. He hit the man swiftly with power in the force of the slam, drove the man to his knees. Melvin pulled back hard as he could with both hands, while bending his knees into the man's shoulder blades. The poor, wretched soul reached back trying to fight off the surprise attack, but by the time he thought to act to defend himself, the taut piano wire had already done mortal damage. The wire instantly cut through the man's flesh and dug so deeply that he was unable to squeeze his fingers between the wire and his own throat to separate the two. The man stopped fighting after his artery was cut and the windpipe crushed under the extreme pulls from Melvin's capable hands. The body slumped. Melvin pulled a few seconds longer for good measure. Melvin was desperately out of breath, and as he released the wire in his hands, he fell backward in a sitting position against the restroom wall. He removed his gloves, filled with the sweat from his palms, and he placed them in his jacket pocket. He spun the wire around in one hand, slipping it into his other pocket, and dragged the lifeless body back into the restroom. He slipped out of the restroom and simply walked away unencumbered. He managed to reach his car parked on Fillmore Street. He felt as if he was coming down with a cold. That annoying headache was back, and he had a scratchy throat. The San Francisco Police Department was baffled. They'd received two anonymous riddles, slightly encrypted but easily solved, from someone, assuming that the same person had sent both newspapers, pasted letters, spelling out riddles they thought by now bodies would have turned up. But no such case. Maybe it was a prank of some sort, but they thought it best to do an investigation initially. Detective Nazarian sat alone in his cubicle with a workload that would choke a horse. He was baffled by the strange riddles across his desk to investigate. There was something intriguing about the simplicity of these encrypted messages, but he had no body, no motive, no crime, no murder, and no witnesses. So far as he was concerned, this was a cold case. He filed it on his desk in a file that read, "Possible, but not probable." Melvin's next murder would be more complicated. He wanted to kill a religious figure. In his mind, a riddle from his childhood was spinning around like clothes in a washing machine. You stand at the entry of a labyrinth with two entrances. Next to each of the entrance, there stands a guard. You know the following things. One path leads to paradise, the other to death. From where you stand, you cannot distinguish between the two paths. Worse, once you start down a path, you cannot turn back. One of the two guards always tells the truth. The other guard always lies. Unfortunately, it's impossible for you to distinguish between the two guards. You have permission to ask one guard one question to ascertain which path leads to paradise. Remember that you don't know which guard you've been asking, the truth teller or the liar, and that this single question determines whether you live or die. The question is, what one question asked of one guard guarantees that you are led onto the path to paradise, regardless of which guard you happen to ask? The answer to the riddle was, if I asked the other guard, which door would he indicate leads to paradise? I always take the door opposite to what's indicated. Regardless of whom you ask, they'll point to the wrong door. He chose Grace Cathedral, located on Knob Hill, for the next murder. Melvin was not a religious man by any standard. As a matter of fact, one might say that by not attending a church, Melvin believed he was being saved from the law of oblivion. Melvin took the time to drive by Grace Cathedral, grinning to himself. He thought maybe that the first two riddles were too easily solved and hoped that this third one would grab someone's attention. Yeah, it walks on all four in the morning. Two legs at noon and three legs in the evening. What, was it far too easy? He thought of the answer. A person. He considered it for a few seconds before making a stop at a religious store that supplied beads of brass trinkets such as crucifixes and candle holders, along with rosaries, long robes, scapulars, and books and Bibles. It was there he purchased a heavy metal cross with sharp edges and points. "Indeed, this will do nicely," Melvin happily said. Melvin found his way home and prepared for his next theatrical act of murder. He dressed in a black suit and left the apartment, being sure to lock the deadbolt on his door tightly upon departure. Melvin arrived at the church and entered the sanctuary. Melvin concealed the metal cross down the back of his pants and covered it with his pocket. He was focused on delivering a fatal blow to the heart of a priest. He instinctually scanned his surroundings and found himself alone. The room seemed hollow, like a hole bored into a piece of wood by a would-be. The walls breathed like asthmatic lungs. His vision blurred, and he stepped forward, making his way to the front of the sanctuary, passing by each pew, closing in on him from both sides, until he was squeezed tight at the altar. His reactive mind could not help but invent devils, but he thwarted these minor thoughts by finding a door. The door led to a hallway of doors. Melvin's affinity with death gave him the courage to walk down the hallway, but not only peering into the empty rooms with open doors, but the boldness needed to try each doorknob of the closed ones. He heard the shuffling of paper in the next room. He paused, held his breath, became transfixed, and reached for the cross at the small of his back. He didn't hesitate to poke his head around the door casing. Sitting at a desk was a priest, still in his vestments. The priest noticed Melvin right away, and with a look of puzzlement, he said, as if to ask a question, "I believe you're lost." "Not lost, priest. I have found my way." He sheepishly smirked. The priest stood to his feet. "Well, you'll have to make an appointment if you wish to meet with me." Melvin disregarded the priest's words and flopped arrogantly in the visitor's chair while slipping on his leather gloves. He said, "I believe that this constitutes an audience." "This is very unorthodox," the priest said, growing tired of this insolence. "I suppose I am upsetting the balance of your Holy One." Melvin clasped his gloved fingers together to tighten the leather. Melvin did not hesitate. He produced the cross swiftly, and with a single thrust, the stripes, the vertical part of the cross, drove into the chest of the priest. He made a grasping grunt. The eyes of the priest seemed to be in disbelief, staring at the face of the very evil his Christ was to protect him from. Melvin added a twist and pulled hard upward while driving the folding priest backward to the floor. Melvin tightened his grip on the cross even more and yanked hard on the cross, dragging the priest forward. The cross was stuck in the priest's chest, wedged between bone. The priest clung to the cross, struggling for air. Melvin wanted his cross back. He paid good money for it, so again he wrestled it, this time with his left foot pushing against the priest's chest. With one final jerk and a kick, the cross was loose, and the priest was affirmably dead. Melvin didn't take the time to gloat. His head hurt. His throat was raw, and he had tightness in his chest as if he had an infection. He needed to find a drugstore and pick up some cold medicine. Monday night, Melvin contemplated the next murder. He took double the dose of non-drowsy cold medicine to relieve his cold symptoms. His body was fevered, clipped more words from yesterday's paper. "I give you a group of three. One is sitting down and will never get up. The second eats as much as is given him, yet he's always hungry. The third goes away and never returns." The answers were stove, fire, and smoke. "I'm always hungry. I must always be fed. Finger I touch will soon turn red. Fire." Melvin had everything nice and tidy, just like his last three murders. The only exception was making two separate packages. One was for the police, and the second was for the newspaper. He typed the words, "Catch me if you can," on the outside of the envelopes this time. Something concerned him. He walked to his jacket and reached into the pocket, feeling for the pair of gloves that he wore during all three murders. He pulled them out into view and examined them closely. Something was missing from the gloves. There was no blood. Melvin thought, "I'm a natural." With restless sleep, he was up early, taking his two packages to the post office and dropped them into the public slot. Melvin casually began looking for the next person to die. A Buick with a single gray-haired driver backed their car right out into the highway, causing Melvin to slam on his brakes, inches from the old man's bumper. The only thing Melvin could see through his tunnel vision was the handicap tag hanging from the rearview mirror and the middle finger of the old man flying it in Melvin's direction. He thought, another boundary point, and rightly justified. Melvin took note of the driveway where the elderly man had recklessly backed out from. Melvin returned to the elderly man's house. He pulled into the driveway and gave the front of the house a thorough look over. Melvin noticed that the houses in this neighborhood all had gas meters. These meant that the right tinkering and know-how, well, one could cause a very substantial explosion. LP gas and a match. Melvin would surely make the news. It wasn't long before the elderly man returned home. He had a case of Bud Light in his hands and marched into his house through the front door. Melvin estimated the man to be in his late 70s. Melvin strolled upon the man's front porch and pushed the doorbell button. Melvin could hear the man grumbling as his feet slapped the hardwood floor inside. The door opened, and now Melvin was face to face with his next target. "What do you want?" The man's voice was gargled and filled with spite. With no warning, Melvin threw a straight right punch, squarely connecting with the man's nose. The old man awkwardly fell, straight back and flat on his back. Melvin rushed into the house and slammed the door shut. He paced while looking down at the man who was bleeding profusely from the nose and mouth.
"No, no, no, don't be dead. You'll ruin everything," Melvin said to himself.
He flopped down on the floor next to the man's unresponsive body and put his ear near the man's mouth.
"Yes, yes, yes, yes,"
Melvin said with delight. The elderly man was still breathing. Melvin struggled to drag the man to a recliner, leaving the body slumped over the arm of the chair. He went into the kitchen and rummaged until he found a book of matches. The house had several candles scattered throughout, so Melvin lit them all and returned to the kitchen, where he muscled the kitchen stove out into the middle of the floor. About the time he was prepared to kick the gas line loose from the back of the stove, he heard the voice of someone moaning. In a panic, he raced into the TV room where the old man was stumbling about disoriented. In a cartoonish move, Melvin, who was behind the wounded man, gave a karate chop to the side of the old man's neck. The man buckled to the ground. Returning to the kitchen, he kicked and stomped with reckless abandon the gas line coming from the wall into the back of the stove. When the line finally gave way, the sound of gas pouring out from the broken line whooshed out. It was time for Melvin to make his exit. He was parked far enough away to watch the excitement, but not close enough to be impacted. It was just a few minutes, and the sound seemed to go out of the air for a brief second, then the explosion. The concussion and force were powerful enough to Melvin that it shattered all the windows of the houses as fires could be seen burning through every glassless window. Car alarms had been set up. Dogs were barking wildly. Melvin now had his number four, and this one would make the papers for sure. He was enthralled at his achievement. If he had known killing was going to be this absolutely fabulous and easy, he may have made a career of murder rather than writing romance novels. Melvin lay on the bathroom floor against the cold tile. He didn't know how long he'd been there. The last thing that he remembered was having a nosebleed and going to the bathroom. Melvin managed to pull himself off the floor using the sink. Thoughts swirled in Melvin's head, all scrambled, until they settled on three words: kill the weatherman. He despised meteorologists. He began concocting a riddle for the police and the newspaper. Melvin wrote scribbles on a blank sheet of white paper, toiling under the weight of time restraints, until he came up with the next riddle. A man was out for a walk when it began to rain. He was not holding an umbrella, nor was he wearing a hat. His clothes were drenched, but not a hair in his head was wet. How could this be? Easing back in his chair, he looked at the riddle he'd composed and exuberantly vocalized. "Bald. The man's bald. That ignorant, miscreant weatherman is also bald." Melvin madly went about clipping the words from the newspaper, giggling audibly, allowing some of the discarded paper to litter the floor. Tomorrow, the weatherman had to die. Tuesday morning, Melvin awoke and thought today was killing day. He had a sense of liveliness pulsating through his body. The San Francisco Chronicle, the police, and Channel 7 News would receive the next riddle. He hurried the morning along, dropping all three envelopes at once into the postage slot. Melvin crossed back over the 80, headed straight for the News Channel building. Parking, the only thing he could do was to slump down in the seat, be inconspicuous, and wait for the bald weatherman to appear. The weatherman eventually came out, went to his BMW Active Hybrid 3, and drove away. Melvin pulled behind him and kept a distance as the two vehicles motored down the highway. Melvin was led to the dark part of the city, It was a disgusting area of adult bookstores, strip clubs, and sleazy bars. Melvin felt sick just by being in the area. The weatherman turned on his turn signal and pulled into a porn shop called Theater X. He drove to the fenced-in private area in the back while Marvin parked out front. Melvin had no desire to enter this den of iniquity. Melvin never turned off his car. He had a full tank of gas, and he was running the heater at full blast. He could not get warm. He was drowning in perspiration, yet his body temperature was like ice. It took the weatherman 15 minutes to emerge from the porn store. He slid into his car and drove away. Melvin pulled up behind him and cautiously followed him from a distance. The weatherman drove to the Castro district. Melvin watched the weatherman park his car in an unlit space on a side street. Within a few minutes, a young man approached the car on the passenger side. There seemed to be a dialogue going on between the two, and the young man walked away. He saw no better opportunity than right now. He clutched a brass, two-bladed ice scraper in his hand. Melvin left the concealment of his automobile and approached the weatherman sitting in his BMW. He approached the driver's side, tapping on the side window. The weatherman spun his head around and flinched, startled by the sudden appearance of a stranger on the driver's side. The weatherman put a small crack in his window, and with apprehensiveness, he choked out the words, "Yes, can I help you?" Melvin broadly smiled. "Absolutely. I'm a bit turned around. I drove down here by mistake. I took a wrong turn somewhere, and I was afraid to keep driving in circles, so I parked the car. Now, these young men keep approaching my car, and I was nervous wreck until I saw you pull up. I figured driving a BMW, you were either lost, too, or at least you could point me in the right direction. I'm not from this area, and just being here gives me the willies." The weatherman must have believed every word of Melvin's fib because he rolled down the window. Melvin thought about how ridiculous the weatherman looked with his bad hairpiece and fake thick eyebrows. "Yes, what you need to do," the weatherman said helpfully, as he turned his head in the opposite direction, about to give Melvin directions, when Melvin, with his left hand clenched monstrously tight, rammed the sharp edges of the brass-tipped ice scraper into the weatherman's neck. The first thrust was deep enough to cut the carotid artery. The weatherman reached with both hands as the second blow came, digging deeply into the backside of his right hand. Melvin attacked him again and again while the weatherman's arms frantically flailed wildly, unable to halt the battery. The weatherman eventually slumped over in the seat. Knowing that his fifth victim was dead, Melvin casually walked unseen back to his automobile, inhaled deeply, and slowly released his breath. His gloves came off and were gently placed in the passenger seat. He checked his passenger side mirror and took one more look at the BMW. He hadn't driven far at all when a motorcycle gang of a dozen bikers blew past him like he was sitting still. These were the cold-hearted types in their leathers, dangling chains, roaring about the city like bandits from the Wild West. Melvin was not happy at all with the loudness of the motorcycles and the inconsiderate way they'd leapfrogged around him. He was appalled at their zipping in and out of traffic, weaving dangerously through traffic as if they owned the road. He mumbled, "Stinking putrid bikers." He loathed these sorts of people. He was positive that one of them must die. Melvin arrived home to collapse upon his sofa. He was ill with fever, sweats, pain in his chest, a throbbing headache, and a sore throat, but he was determined to beat this affliction. He had more killing to do. He laid his head upon the desk and fell asleep. When he awoke, his shirt was soaking wet, and his first thought was, "Where am I?" Then the second thought, "What day is this?" His fear was that he had slept through Wednesday and had missed his next kill. But he looked at the date on his computer, which confirmed it was Wednesday, 6 a.m. Melvin had a terrible rush of emotion overwhelm him, and he sank into his chair. It was full of fluid vitality and laughed hysterically, tears rolling uncontrollably down his face as he realized this great emotional charge. As quickly as the hysteria had started, he froze with a serious thought. Melvin had been rummaging through the daily paper, cutting out words, until the riddle in his head was readable on the cutout words in front of him. He placed the words carefully together to form the following riddle. When the sun is out, I am hot. When it rains, I am wet. When it snows, I am cold. I eat bugs. I am moved by the wind. I roar like a lion, and the ground rumbles when I go by. Few see the dark side and live. Melvin made up three identical riddles as he had done previously. He glued the letters on a plain white piece of paper, typed, "Catch me if you can," on the paper, addressed the white envelopes, and prepared to visit the post office. Melvin's thoughts were bouncing through his mind like reflective light through a laser maze. After mailing the three envelopes, Melvin turned his attention to scoping the city for just the right biker. His mind was ripe and his heart raced when he caught sight of the bike and its outlaw rider. The biker pulled his motorcycle to the back of Melvin's car. Melvin went to his car, watching the huge bearded man in leather and chains wiping off his gas tank. Melvin had to think quickly. This was the perfect opportunity, but what should he do? Melvin had a brainstorm. Went to his passenger side door, opened it, and reached into his glove box, removing a metal, chrome, flip-top lighter. He slipped into his leather gloves, quickly wiping down the metal with a tissue. He proceeded by doing the unimaginable. He removed the nozzle, allowing the gas to pour out onto the ground. The biker paid no attention at first. He was looking the other way. By the time he'd turned to face Melvin, he was standing unaware in a couple of gallons of gasoline. Melvin stood holding the gas nozzle, smiling at the biker. The biker wasn't amused. He looked at Melvin and said, "What do you think you're looking at?" Melvin smiled idiotically. "You deaf? I asked you, what are you looking at, boy?" Melvin's smile warped into a scowl. "I'm looking at a human fireball." As Melvin answered, the biker looked down at his feet and realized that he was standing in a puddle of gasoline. Melvin turned the nozzle toward the biker and sprayed a heavy stream of gasoline into the biker's face. The biker screamed out even before Melvin dropped the burning lighter at the biker's feet. Melvin had set him ablaze. Instead of stopping, dropping, and rolling, he began to run blindly across the parking lot. Melvin dropped the gas hose, returned to his car, and drove away, glancing only once in his rearview mirror to see the flaming man crumble to the ground. When Melvin arrived home, he went straight to his shower. His sickness had intensified and his body burned with fever. While he was no expert, his mind's eye had diagnosed something malignant within. He wished death upon himself as the cold water poured down upon his naked body. He was not bathing, but rather he was using the shower therapeutically. He was afraid to take his own temperature for fear that he might really be dying. The day was getting away from him, and he desperately needed to gain control over whatever demon had chosen him, clung to him, and was boring into his brain. Unless this angel of darkness killed him, he would not be deterred. Detective Rogers leaned over his boss's shoulder, looking at the computer screen. What he and Detective Nazarian viewed was data on missing people from the San Francisco area within the last 6 months. Detective Rogers was trying to get to the bottom of the mysterious riddles he'd been receiving anonymously. He didn't know how to investigate a crime that he had no proof had occurred. The two homicide detectives who understood the multifaceted and multidisciplinary approach to solving homicides had only the riddles to go on because they had no crime or crime scene. Their only evidence was the simply solved riddles without fingerprints. A miscellaneous file had been started, recording the dates that each riddle had been mailed and received. Photos of the packages and content had been photographed. This was the thinnest file the station had, and the most impossible to solve. The answers in the order of the riddles received thus far were man, he, pointing to the other door, fire, bald, motorcycle. Both homicide detectives had full caseloads and needed to file this mystery away for the time being. There was no reason for them to chase shadows. Phantoms were not tangible. They needed something to sink their investigative teeth into. Melvin did not tarry. He raced home to prepare his seventh riddle for the police and newspaper. Meticulously, as before, he took precious time cutting out all the letters from the newspaper and gluing them to a blank white sheet of paper. It read, "When young, I am sweet in the sun. When middle-aged, I make you gay. When old, I am valued more than ever." The answer, of course, was wine. Unquestionably, this would rouse their interest. Melvin wasn't feeling well. He had a horrible stabbing pain in his chest. He attributed it to indigestion from his dinner and was forced to take an antacid tablet to settle his nausea and discomfort. The following morning, first things first, he made the long drive to draw up his last riddle in the post box and return to his apartment. As he walked through the door, he noticed on his desk that the envelopes he used to send out the riddles to the police and media were somehow in different positions on the desk. How could this be? Melvin was dumbfounded. He then began to have apprehension and doubt. He started questioning himself. Had he used the plain white envelopes? Had he double-checked? I used the right envelopes, not the ones with my writer's name, Simon Hardy, on it. Surely not. I would not be that negligent. That would be unforgivable. But he had a suspicion that there was something wrong. He convinced himself that all was well and he was only being paranoid. He had work to do. There was no time for him to second guess at this point. Melvin loved the old classic movie Arsenic and Lace with Cary Grant. This was where two old women, Cary Grant's aunts, were actually serial killers. This gave Melvin the idea about using the arsenic. He'd ordered off the internet enough arsenic, inorganic, to kill a buffalo. He'd also purchased fentanyl from a drug dealer that he used to buy other illegal substances from when he was younger. The dealer reminded him that this drug was deadly. Melvin only said, "I hope so." For this, his seventh murder, Garland loaded two syringes with the Reaper's mixture of arsenic and fentanyl. This concoction would produce pulmonary edema leading to death. His plan was a simple one. He entered the local liquor store and went straight for the corked wine bottles. With a bit of effort, for the corks were frustratingly tight, he pushed the needle through the cork and emptied the contents into one red wine and one white wine. He giggled to himself like a giddy schoolgirl as he exited the store for home. He was proud of himself. The deed had been done. It would not be long until the deaths were reported, and both brands of wine would be recalled. He couldn't wait for the excitement. Melvin had just not felt right these past few days. He was suffering from headaches, stomach viruses, numerous hot flashes, and felt generally ill. Two more victims, only two. Melvin invented his riddle for the eighth victim, not yet chosen. He felt very clever with himself. The riddle was, you can take 8/8 and using only addition, make 1,000? The answer was, 888 plus 88 plus 8 plus 8 plus 8 equals 1,000. He characterized the note with, "Catch me if you can." He smiled to himself and began cutting up a newspaper, being fastidious with his scissors. His mind considered the eighth victim. After reflecting on his options, he decided his next victim should be a patient in the hospital. He'd thought about maybe a doctor or a male intern, but then he reminded himself that he himself was unwell and would not want to snuff out someone who possibly would treat him if he turned for the worst. He would do the deed tonight. After serious contemplation and a late dinner, Melvin made his way from his apartment to the general hospital. His goal was to make it to the ICU on the third floor. Melvin made a stop at the mailbox along the way to the hospital, where he dropped the notes that he'd created for the local paper and the police concerning his eighth victim. Melvin was scouring the halls of the hospital, working his way to the ICU. He paused long enough near the waiting room to overhear a discussion about a man who had been shot by police. He was in one of the rooms on this floor. From what he gathered, the wounded man was a known burglar. This critically injured patient was unguarded, on life support, and would probably never wake up. The police were interested in questioning him about some sexual attacks as well. Melvin thought, what a scumbag. His heart was beating hard in his chest. He tried to slow his breathing. He felt cold and clammy, as if he was having night sweats. Noticing a closet door in the hallway ajar, he slipped quickly into the closet in hopes to find some hospital scrubs.
Great day, he mumbled excitedly, finding a couple of pairs of scrubs hanging.
The first set was too small, but the second set he tried on, though a bit tight, would do the trick. He emerged from the closet unseen and made his way deeper down the hall until he located the room where his victim lay on life support. There was not a soul in sight. Melvin thought, wanted for sexual assault and no police presence. What in this world is it coming to?
He eased into the man's room. There were machines around his bed, some making beeping noises, others flashing LED lights. He eyed the ventilator that was keeping this criminal alive and knew from reading it that it was a simple flick of a switch to turn it off. He probed around a bit with his fingers until he found it, and without hesitation or a moment of reflection, he flipped it off. There was a gasp from the patient, and that was it. Melvin was waiting for the death rattle, or the sound of desperate wheezing or gulping or something, but there wasn't anything. He peered at his victim, studying the face, trying to read what he might be experiencing at this very moment. What was he thinking or feeling, or was he just dead? Where was the agonal gasp? Knowing he couldn't wait around any longer because the nurses would have gotten alert that the ventilator had stopped working, he exited the room, heading in the opposite direction from where he came. The hospital was eerily absent of nurses, so he had no difficulty removing the scrubs he'd borrowed and tossed them carelessly into the doorway of an empty open room. He made his way to the staircase and to his car as quickly as he could without drawing attention. He sat in his car, hyperventilating and panicking. His head ached something terrible, and his throat was severely raw and scratchy. He was sweating profusely, and his skin was on fire. Trepidation was tearing at his reasoning as he was losing all sensibility. He continued to remind himself over and over again, I did it. I did it. I did it. Eventually calm, hypnea restored, he relaxed. Time to go home. He had almost made his quota. He was deathly sick with more symptoms than he could count. He took a double dose of cold medicine and he crawled into bed. San Francisco was waking as Melvin had snuggled with the morning paper and scissors on hand and created another cryptic riddle. The buyer doesn't want it, the user doesn't see it, and the maker doesn't need it. What am I? A coffin. Melvin snickered to himself. Detective Nazarian and Detective Rogers were at their desk when another officer delivered Melvin's riddle to them. Their eyes lit when they saw the name Simon Hardy embossed on the outside beneath Catch Me If You Can. The two detectives began to dig in. The case had been handed to them on a platter. They didn't have a clue who Hardy was. Melvin had made a mistake. The detectives opened the end of the envelope and read the riddle. When young, I'm sweet in the sun. When middle-aged, I make you gay. When old, I'm valued more than ever. They quickly Googled the name. They initially came up with the novelist, Thomas Hardy, from the 1800s. I doubt if he's still kicking, laughed Detective Nazarian. I would say not, Rogers replied. Pretty sure it's not the actor either, Nazarian ruled out.
I got something here, boss, Rogers confirmed.
Nazarian said, talk to me. Rogers read what he found. Simon Hardy, San Francisco romance novelist, real name Melvin Garland. Looks like he lost a partner years ago, never recovered, and has been in the psych ward in the past. The two men jumped up with Melvin's address in hand and decided to pay Melvin a visit. The detectives arrived at Melvin's in record time to find he was not home. They discovered from a neighbor who talked to Melvin this morning that he was headed to the bridge. By the time Melvin had reached the bridge, he'd convinced himself that he must be the ninth victim of his plan. He would conclude his killing spree by never going to prison because he would be victim number nine. His thoughts were unraveling. His nerves were coming unglued. He balanced himself on the railing. It looked like a long way down. When Detectives Nazarian and Rogers arrived at the bridge, they had a photograph of Melvin from the back of one of his romance novels. They took different directions, examining each face as they passed by. Melvin looked at the walkway of the bridge to the left, then to the right. His head was pounding. His chest began to heave. Sweat suddenly made his body cold and shiver. His throat grew raw. His eyes saw everything as bleak, and his skin burned. Rogers, who just happened to be coming that way, saw the crowd gathering. He called Nazarian and relayed their position on the bridge to him. They were able to apprehend Melvin. He did not resist and was taken down safely without incident. Detective Nazarian and Detective Rogers determined Melvin was innocent of every crime he had admitted to. There were no murders except the murders committed in Melvin's mind. He was diagnosed with a severe and rare case of a form of Munchausen syndrome. This was the cause of his illness and ailments. All were psychosomatic. He wasn't arrested and charged, but he was taken to a hospital for the mentally insane, and there was given treatment. No solid prognosis was agreed to, but they would treat him as long as it took him to get well. The detectives visited Melvin Garland on a couple of occasions, but Melvin no longer existed. Melvin was lost in the world of Simon Hardy and would theatrically recite lines from his romantic novels for the entire hospital to enjoy. I hope you enjoyed Nine Lives by Dale Thompson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And more than that, a thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. And if you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases, and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. And you can subscribe to me on YouTube as well, at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. 10 years now. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?